We move our way into hour number three here on Jones and Keefe, WEEI 93.7, Boston Sports Original. Dan Ball, John Lyons in for the fellas here on this Monday. Our number, 617-779-7937. You can call, you can text to join the conversation. Make sure you follow the show at Jones and Keefe on Twitter and Instagram. My man John Lyons can be found at The Real John Lyons on Twitter and the newly established at John Lyons 78 on Instagram. How was your Instagram experience, Ben?
Yeah, I waited until March of 2025 to make one. So, you know, only like 10 years after
everyone
else.
Just when the cool kids are getting there. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's been okay.
Okay.
So far.
No real issues to speak of so far. Twitter's a cesspool at this point.
Yeah,
so
Twitter's
probably
so much
a little refreshing
over
honestly.
The past 5 years.
Yeah.
Twitter's gotten way. So Instagram's not bad.
Good.
You know?
Good. Make sure you go follow my guy if you haven't already. I'm at Dan Ball on all socials, B-A-H-L. Okay, let's move over to the NBA. First of all, breaking news not worthy of the sounder. Tyrese Halliburton's father, John, will be allowed to attend Pacers home games in a suite. That's a key detail. Beginning with Tuesday's pivotal game 4 against the Knicks, sources tell ESPN's. This is Shams who's reporting it. John Halliburton missed 8 games following a confrontation with Giannis Antetokounmpo at April 29th. He's lucky that it didn't go worse than it did when those two met. Yeah. So that leads us into a conversation on the NBA, the Knicks and the Pacers. Karl Anthony Towns 20-15 to spark a 20-point comeback for the Knicks to make it a 2-1 series. Knicks have 3 20-point comebacks, the most in a single postseason for a team since 1998. The Knicks are in this situation by way of defeating the Boston Celtics. So I ask you a very broad question to open up our conversation on this. The New York Knicks are in this situation right now. The Boston Celtics are working on their golf game here on this Memorial Day weekend. Why?
Two reasons. I mean, there's a lot of reasons, but there are two that stand out. I think one is the health of Kristaps Porzingis, and the other one, and I said this the day after the series ended when I was on with Mego, the Knicks were mentally and physically tougher than the Celtics throughout that series.
Okay.
And that is something that when you look at the Celtics over the last 3 years, let's just take Joe Mazzulla's tenure. 2023, they lost to a Miami team. They were more talented then because Miami was mentally and physically tougher than them. Got up 3-0, then withstood the Celtics' comeback, won Game 7 in Boston. Then last year, the Celtics were the tougher team. They were tougher than Miami. They were tougher than Cleveland. They were tougher than Indiana and much tougher than Dallas. I mean, they pushed Dallas around in that NBA Finals.
Were they the tougher team or were they just so much more skilled than the
teams
that
they were playing?
Well, they
got Halliburton to quit. And I like Halliburton.
That's fair.
But they also, you look at that Cleveland series. Donovan Mitchell scores 45 in game 2, ties the series up. People start to get nervous. Tatum has 33 points in back-to-back games. You go up 3-1. You win game 5 at home. And you're right. They were more talented. I'm not disputing that.
Yeah.
But they were also tough. And against Dallas, they were much tougher than Dallas, start to finish in that series, and they won in 5. But then this year, it almost reverts back to 2023, where they stood up to Orlando, but it felt like Orlando was just as tough as them, at times maybe a little tougher. But they got by him. They stood up to him. But then the Knicks were mentally and physically tougher, games 1 and 2. How about game 4? Right now, game 4, the moment we remember is Tatum getting hurt.
Yeah.
But in the second half of game 4, the Celtics allowed 70 points in the second half to a bad Knicks offense. Like a Knicks, and I know the Knicks offensive rating was high this year. I think it was top 5. But in that series, I mean, the Knicks struggled to get to 100 in game 1. It took them overtime. And then in game 2, the Knicks scored 91 points. Yet you gave up 70 in the second half of game 4.
Right.
Like, so that to me. And I think, look, and I know people think it's an excuse. I'm just trying to look at it realistically. If Porzingis was actually healthy, I think you win at least one of those first two games at home, probably both, and we're having a different conversation. That doesn't excuse them, though, taking, what, 18 threes out of 19 shots in the third quarter of one of those games. It doesn't excuse them blowing 20-point leads, but I do think it was a big factor. But I think the toughness thing, like the Porzingis health thing, you can find a way in the offseason to fix that. Either he miraculously gets healthy, or you trade for someone else in a similar role who maybe not isn't as good but is more reliable. The toughness thing is something you really got to look in the mirror, because that's going to be a little bit harder to fix in the offseason.
That was certainly evident. That was evident in both series. The one difference being Orlando's just so young.
And they're so bad offensively.
Yeah, that's
it. Like they would go
it.
6 minutes at a time and score 8 points.
One kind of impacts the other. Like there's very clearly talent. I think Orlando's going to be in the playoff conversation for a while based on a guy like Banchero who's young. And I know Jalen Suggs was hurt, but he's also young. They have a young core that it looks like they're putting together. They work hard. They just – they can't score their way out of a paper bag. In that Knicks series, to your point, that was the biggest takeaway for me was, wow, this team fights. They grind. Even on days where maybe they don't have their best stuff shooting or they're just playing Hacker Robinson the entire way, they're fighting for each other. They're fighting for themselves. They're fighting for their coach. They play really well in their system. And Tom Thibodeau puts a system in there that is not easy to play in and play for. So you need a certain mindset of player to be able to withstand the way that he doesn't really rotate his players that deep on the bench and how much he asks of you defensively. They put together a group that really fits the coach and fits the system that they're playing for and really seem to like fighting for and with each other. The Celtics just wilted under the kind of pressure that was being created.
Yeah, and I look at this series with the Pacers and the Knicks and like how Thibodeau has managed his team, and especially Rick Carlisle, and I know they lost last night, but on the whole. And then I look at Joe Mazzulla, who I thought did a great job last year, but I look at this series and I'm like, why did it take so long to go to Luke Kornet when Porzingis clearly like had trouble breathing?
Yeah.
Why did it take so long to go to Kornet? And why did Peyton Pritchard not play that much in the first two games? Then all of a sudden, game three plays a ton, you win. Game five plays a ton, you win. Why is the sixth man of the year not playing more in the first two games of the year? And I think the toughness thing, like we look at the Celtics as this really deep, tough team. The Knicks role players were better than the Celtics role players. And this, I mean, Josh Hart against the Celtics in the regular season shot 1 of 9 from three. In this series, 11 of 30. Like your defense evaporated at times. Like OG Anunoby averaged 9 points per game against the Celtics in the regular season. Averaged 14 points per game in the playoff series, had 3 20-point games. And also, too, not to put them off, how did the first two games end, Dan? Game one, your Supermax Finals MVP, Jaylen Brown, has the ball ripped away from him.
Yep.
How does game two end? Your Supermax top three MVP finisher, Jason Tatum, has the ball ripped away from him.
The manifestation of toughness.
Like, really?
In those two plays.
And it's one thing, too. Like, okay, let's say you lost game one. The Knicks snuck up on you a little bit. It's still a bad sign. Like, did they sneak up on you? You had one bad shooting second half. For it to happen twice and to end the same way, like you have a 20-point lead, it evaporates because you keep shooting and missing a bunch of threes. Your defense wears off, and then you get the ball ripped away from one of your Supermax guys. Like, that to me, after game two, I'm like, oh, man, they're in, like, real, real trouble here.
And that leads to the point that you bring up about them being tough mentally, physically, the things that we usually say define champions really across any sport. They were so incredibly talented last year, not saying that they couldn't be a tough team when the situation counted for it. When they had the confidence that they were playing extremely well, it did seem like that toughness kind of came as almost a sub factor of that, or a kind of a symptom of them playing really well, is what I was going for. But as soon as the going got tough, this team wilted under that kind of pressure.
It happened 2 years ago.
So it makes me wonder, have they been a tough team at certain points and it disappeared in 2024-25, or are they not really built to be a tough team? They were just so good that they weren't really put in situations where they had to be overly tough and overly mentally strong, if that makes sense.
No, and I think that's one of the things I mentioned, they have to look in the mirror. Was last year an anomaly?
Yeah.
Like, was last year like, hey, you were tougher than Dallas, and I thought you were tougher than a good Indiana team, but was that an anomaly? And is Miami 2 years ago and the Knicks this year closer to what you are, toughness-wise? Because they've had the best roster in the NBA the last 2 years.
Right.
They have. Last year they won a championship, and I'm not taking that away from them. I really hope Celtics fans appreciated that, because as we saw with Tatum's Achilles, all this, you never know what can happen. So I just want to say that. But you wonder and you worry, was that the anomaly? Because it felt like the Knicks spent all year and they built their team in the offseason saying, we're going to beat the Celtics. And that's why they traded for Karl Anthony Towns. That's why they traded for Bridges. That's their whole MO was, we are going to beat the Celtics. So the Celtics should have known this was coming, and they should have seen it coming. And then when you sweep them in the regular season, but you go back, opening night, you totally blitz them.
Yep.
Then you blow them out again. Then you beat them by 13. And then you beat them by 2 in overtime. So it's getting closer. They really shouldn't have snuck up on you, and you shouldn't have been surprised that they were so tough. But it felt like the Celtics walked away from these first two games almost like they walked away from that first three games against Miami last year. Like, wow, we can't believe these guys are beating us in these key situations. It's like, you shouldn't have been surprised by that.
And it it was so obvious that in, I think it was December, right after the second time that they played, Jalen Brunson said in the media, the Celtics are our barometer for being a championship level team. I'm paraphrasing, but they are our barometer for it being a championship level team. We are not there yet. That was the conclusion that he came to publicly in the media. Anybody could watch that. If I saw it, they could see it. And to your point, then all of a sudden, the goalposts move a little bit. Now they're a little bit closer. Clearly, whatever they took away from games one and two, it gets a little better in game three. Then in game four, oh, look at this. We're right there till the very end in another relatively low-scoring game where you're able to kind of limit the Celtics' ability to shoot the three. This is all in the regular season. And then the pendulum finally swings over in the playoffs where they crack the code. It's going to be ugly. It's going to be dirty. It's going to be gritty. We can't let them get into a flow. We got to make them uncomfortable when they're shooting the three. And all of that worked. And so where was that counterpunch? Going back to your original point, it just wasn't there.
And I look at these two teams, the Knicks and the Pacers, playing in this series. And the Halliburton is great. They're a great team. They were in the Eastern Conference Finals last year. The Knicks beat you, and they're good. But I watched this series, and I'm like, man, even without Jason Tatum, like, the Celtics should be just as good as these two teams. You know, maybe better than one of them. And that's why, too, like, Tatum gets hurt, but you're still well on your way. If Tatum never dives for that ball and never gets injured, you're still well on your way to being down 3-1 in that series.
Right.
And that's where, to me, that's why I mentioned the Porzingis thing, but the toughness thing. Because even that game, the Celtics were up by 14 in the third quarter, and it evaporated.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and at that point, by game four, you should know Porzingis doesn't have it this series. We got to go. You know what I mean?
But
it's not like game one and two, you can be like, all right, you know, let's, you know, he's a great player. He was good at the end of the year. He was good in April. You know, he had a couple good games against the Magic. Let's see how it goes. By game four, that's not a surprise anymore. By game four, you should be able to find a way to win that game. And even in that game, Tatum had 42 points. How many of those possessions were Tatum bring it up, dribble, 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 three, goes in,
right.
Great, but like not great ball movement. All the things that we talked about last year, great ball movement, consistently great defense, right? Obviously great shooting, I know, but a variation in your offense. We couldn't really say those things against the Knicks. Ball movement wasn't good enough. The pace was okay numbers-wise, but your ball movement never felt good enough. You didn't shoot well overall. Your defense was wildly inconsistent. Again, just all those things that you won a championship with last year largely evaporated against the Knicks, and that's why I'm sitting here like at my house watching the game last night like, damn, like the Celtics should be playing tonight. Instead, they're not.
They are not. The Knicks and Pacers are. And the Celtics, meanwhile, have a near $500 million bill when it comes to the players they're paying and the tax bill that they're supposed to accumulate right now.
No big deal.
No, but that's, you know, it's
Bill Chisholm, glad you bought that team.
Yeah, that's right. You know, that's pocket change for most of us in these parts. But where did the Celtics go from here with John's bar that he has set now, still being better than the Knicks and the Pacers and trying to track down the Cleveland Cavaliers? Can they accomplish that this offseason while inevitably probably having to take away from certain spots of the roster? We explore that after Tom Crisafulli tells you what's trending. Tom, I don't know if you said that in my ear or you said that over the air. Why are you playing this song?
This is for Tatum.
This is for Tatum. Are you doing okay? Are you handling this okay?
I've had my ups and downs. My mother is certainly not helping because she is a huge Jaylen Brown fan. So after that Game 5 win, she was strutting around the house like, they don't need Tatum, this and that. So I'm struggling. I can't talk about it with my mother. I do love her. I'm getting there.
good qualifier there at the end. Make sure you end with that part of the sentence. Back here on Jones and Keefe, WEEI, Dan Ball and John Lyons in for the guys here on this Monday, getting you ready for Red Sox baseball. 1:10 pregame with my hero, Joe Weil. He will jump in 1:10 pre, 2:10 first pitch. Garrett Crochet against Chad Patrick as the matchup for game one of this three-game series. Afternoon game, night game, afternoon game, which is kind of a wild setup. But we ended our last segment talking about the Boston Celtics. The sky is falling, or so we've been told. $464 million committed in payroll next season in salaries and repeat luxury tax penalties, ESPN's Bobby Marks previously had reported. So again, we're talking in the near $500 million range for the bill that is being inherited by Bill Chisholm and company. So changes seem to be inevitable. This is a team that brought back 15 of 17 players going into this season after their incredible run a season ago. So
they brought back O'Shea Brissett, they would have won it all.
Yeah. Might have been the X factor.
Yeah.
If you ask Ken Laird, the X factor in these playoffs, Nemus Keita. He was the one who did not get enough run in these playoffs. That's Ken's take.
He got no run.
got no
basically,
run.
Basically, yeah.
So maybe there's your issue all along. So let's talk about the moving parts for this team, because your overall point, I think, that you've come away with in watching this current Eastern Conference Finals, this iteration of the Celtics, when healthy, were able to handle both of these teams. So knowing that Jason Tatum is out, how conceivable is it that whatever version of the Celtics that they are going to be next year can still be competitive enough to be in a series like this?
So, two biggest questions, Dan, for the Celtics for the next 4 months, but also the next year. Question number one, what is Tatum's actual recovery timeline?
Okay.
Because if it's 9 months, he got injured in mid-May. So 9 months, we're talking about the All-Star break,
right,
in mid to late February. Maybe hold him out till March. But if it's 12 months, then he's toast for the whole season.
Right.
Right? So that's question number one. Question number two, which I think kind of bounces off question one, how much luxury tax is Bill Chisholm actually willing to tolerate? Like, it's one thing to come in and say, we love the Celtics, we love Joe, I grew up a fan. That's great, and I am happy about that.
Yeah.
But that is different than when the bill comes and it's like, here's extra $230 million just to have these guys on top of their salaries, right?
Right.
So that, to me, is the key question. And you said, how good can they be without Tatum? I think this team without Tatum, and Jaylen Brown has the torn meniscus, but assuming he comes back healthy, to me, they're a 4 or 5 seed in the East. You know, I look at it as Cleveland will be better than them in the regular season. Indiana will be better than them. And then you have Orlando and New York. And I think one of them, maybe both, will be better than the Celtics. But that's a 4 or 5 seed right there.
Yeah, you're above the play-in round, which I think is a massive victory.
I think without Tatum, you should still be above the... I think if you're in the play-in round with most of the... And the other thing is you'll not have all these guys back. Hauser could very well be traded, $10 million a year. And then you have Holiday and Porzingis. I think they're going to trade one of them. I think if Tatum's not coming back, they might trade both.
Which,
and that's three guys.
So let's dive into those two guys, because I've seen the same thing that you are. I've seen one of, if not both, of those guys being expendable because of the money, because of the age, because of the injuries. Which one of the two, I guess, would be considered to be more expendable given how they impact this offense?
So I would rather keep Porzingis right now.
Okay.
But here's the issue. There's no clear-cut favorite, because you look at Porzingis, led the NBA in points per post-up last year on offense among qualified, you know, of guys that had at least 100. So he's, you know, arguably the best post-scorer in the NBA, a great post-player regardless, great defender inside, can hit threes from 30 feet out and shoot 38% from three. So there are very few people in the NBA that can do that. And when he was healthy the last 2 years, your offense was borderline unstoppable and you were great defensively. But that's the problem. What does he give you? 40 or 50 games a year. And a big reason why you lost to the Knicks is, once again, he was not healthy. Then you look at Holiday, who generally is more healthy, but he's 34. He just had a hamstring and a finger injury, which in themselves aren't big, but it's now a 34-year-old starting to get nicked up a little bit. Porzingis also is on an expiring deal. Holiday, you got to pay for 3 more years if you keep him. At least 2, you know, you can go to year, but at least 3, 2, 3, 4 more years.
Right.
So I would rather keep Porzingis because of the elements he brings, but it's not an easy conversation. I know there's a lot of people that say you can't trust Porzingis' health, keep Holiday. And the only other piece of this, because you mentioned Nemus Kata, if you trade Porzingis, well, Horford could retire, and even if he comes back, he's 39. Cornett very well could leave in free agency. Whereas at the guard position, you have Derek White and you have Pritchard. So you have a little bit more room to maneuver at guard than I think you do on the front line.
I struggle so much with the Porzingis conversation with this team, because you're 100% right. The way that he impacts this team's ability to score, and the way that he, just with his presence, is able to open up room for other guys to operate, to get cleaner shots away, all the things that you didn't have in that New York series. You could tell that he wasn't in there at his best because of just how much chaos they were able to create for other guys trying to create shots. All of that he brings, he does, the amount of skills that he puts together at the elite level that he does, I'm not sure there's anybody in the league.
Well,
maybe
they call
other
him
the
unicorn
I know,
for a reason,
and
right?
That's why, like, I'm thinking through on the fly, like, somebody other than Nikola Jokic, I'm not sure does the amount of things he does at the size he does, at the skill he does. So all of that is all fine and good, but if I'm missing Tatum until mid-March and I can't bank on him, and it's going to progressively get worse as he gets older, how many games you're going to get from him, that's a lot of unknown quantities for me. But
And I get
the
that.
The depth chart is the depth chart. Like, you can't change the fact that you are progressively getting a lot smaller this offseason with the guys that you are potentially losing. So that's a major issue you have to overcome in that spot.
And it's tough because if Tatum's out for the whole year, then I'm trading both of them and Hauser. And you just get way under the luxury tax, getting a bunch of assets. And you can still be a play. Like, Jaylen Brown, Derek White, Peyton Pritchard, you can still be a playoff team.
Yeah.
And then if you keep one of, you know, Holiday or Porzingis, then I think you're a 4 or 5 seed. But your ceiling is, without Tatum, I think your ceiling is you're a 4 or 5 seed, can maybe win the first round, and you probably lose in the second round. With Tatum, you can be the best team in the NBA and win a championship, right? Like, we just saw that last year. Because even last year, Porzingis was amazing in a couple games in the NBA Finals, but most of the playoffs he was out. So you just saw them win a championship with Tatum as the one, Brown as the two, and really White as the three throughout the playoff run. So you can win a championship. If Tatum comes back in February, they can still win a championship. I believe that. But that's the key question, because if he's not going to come back, then, you know, might as well trade all three, get way under. And then you still, in October 2026, start a year with Pritchard, White, Tatum, and Brown, and hopefully you can fill in from there.
I think I would be leaning towards going after that path. I just don't want to gamble on maybe trying to keep this window open, but also having one eye to the future if you can't know for sure what Tatum's recovery is going to look like. And even if he does get on the court late February, early March, what's that ramp up look like?
Is there a timid factor there, right? Is he a little nervous?
It's pretty conceivable for me to look at him playing 6 weeks or 2 months in the season and still needing a full off season to get back to whatever his new version of 100% is going to be. So I'm working under the guise that this window of winning is now closed, and you closed it on yourself with the injury and the way that you played against the Knicks. I also have a lot of trust in Brad Stevens to be able to take whatever assets you're gaining from Hauser, from Porzingis, from Holiday, to build a pretty damn good lineup when you come back in 26-27. As much as it's going to suck, to your point, I still think you can at least get into a play-in spot with that core of three guys that you have. And your window has now reopened in 26 and beyond, because I have no reason not to trust that Stevens can work some magic with the pieces you've gotten back.
I think the next 12 months are the most pivotal of Brad Stevens' career with the Celtics. And I know, you know, a couple summers ago, he trades Marcus Smart, brings in Porzingis, then he pulls off the Holiday trade. You win a championship. He chose to promote Joe Mazzulla as well the year before. That was massive. But how do they balance this? Like, do they have a clear answer by July on what Tatum's projected recovery is? Like, if they sit there at the beginning of July and they're like, yeah, he's going to probably be back in February, give or take a few weeks. Or, nah, he's out all year. Okay, well, then what do you do? Right? Because can Stevens set them up to be a team that whenever Tatum comes back, whether that's in March or whether that's October 26, that you are a championship-level team? Because people talk about him, hey, modern-day Red Auerbach, all that stuff, and I think he's done an amazing job. I really do. Biggest unsung hero of you winning the championship last year was him,
yep,
putting that all together.
Yeah.
But now you're in a really difficult spot because you have to shed some salary anyway. Even if the Celtics were still playing, they would have to shed salary this summer. But now you have to balance how much do I shed compared with Tatum's recovery timeline, and what do I think Tatum's going to look like when he comes back? Because you have to thread that needle, because once Tatum comes back, you're going to have two top 20 NBA players still in their late 20s in Tatum and Brown.
Right.
That's still a championship window.
Still very much in their prime.
If you augment it correctly.
Right.
And I think that, so to me, these next 12 months are the most important of his entire tenure. Even if he works here another 30 years, we'll look back on these 12 months, I think, as his most important.
Because it's very conceivable to look at Jaylen Brown at 29 going into 30 and, you know, Jason Tatum 28 going into 29 as still having 5 years to win 3, 4, 5. The one thing that does concern me in this entire conversation, what does 100% look like for Jason Tatum coming off of this injury? Is there still that same explosive ability, you know, to spot up and shoot and to dominate the flow of the offense, as you talked about, was on display? Was it a good thing against New York? Maybe not. But where's your level of concern just with Tatum as the individual when he comes back?
Yeah. So does he come back? Let's just say he comes back in March.
Okay.
does he come back and within a month or so he looks like, you know, the old Tatum, who was an all-NBA first team guy four times? Or does he come back kind of like Gordon Hayward came back and he's a little timid, he's a little unsure, which would be on a human level understandable.
Of course.
But that would be a killer for the Celtics, like if that was the case. And yeah. I'm not saying he's going to come back quite like Gordon, but that idea that Gordon Hayward, it felt like mentally never got over that broken leg.
Yeah, yeah. And we have to at least have that conversation at this point.
And my fear is that if you go back to a couple years ago when Tatum sprained his ankle in Game 7 against the Heat, does he look like he did in that game where he can shoot, he can hit some threes, he can move a little, but other than that, he's largely ineffective? Because if that's the Tatum you get, it's not worth him coming back this year. Right. If the Tatum you get is a guy that, hey, you're a 4 seed, you're a 5 seed, now Jason Tatum comes back as you ramp into the playoffs and you can make a run at a championship, then yeah, that's the guy to bring back in March. And that's why I said the biggest question of this offseason is not the luxury tax, it's not Bill Chisholm, it's what is his real timeline. And you also don't want to rush him. Like, you don't want him to come back and then all of a sudden he starts dealing with calf strains or these other little nagging injuries and he's not quite the same guy for 2 years, not just 1 year. Like, that to me is the key question here.
And in all of this, which are all points that come together into the level of uncertainty that makes me go, just rip the Band-Aid off, man. Just make the amount of tough decisions that you need to reset your finances, reset your draft assets, maybe reset the amount of youth that you have in your group, and take your lumps for next season. As much as that's going to suck, you are still talented enough where you're not going to be an unwatchable team. I also think it buys a little bit of time for Joe Mazzulla, because I don't think you're going to turn around and make any decision on your coach with a roster that looks like that. So at very least, it gives him 25, 26 to work on his craft a bit more and continue to get more experienced at what he's doing. And then he gets a chance to coach whatever this new core is going to be in 26, 27. It just buys you the ability to almost, in my mind, have the excuse to make some of these tougher decisions on some of these aging stars.
And the Mazzulla question is interesting, because if you look at Budenholzer wins a championship, gets fired a couple of years later in Milwaukee. Frank Vogel won a championship before that, got fired a couple of years later. So we've seen championships really only buy a couple of years or so of grace for a head coach. Now, the Celtics themselves, they gave Doc Rivers a long time. They gave Brad Stevens a long time. I think they would have given Udoka a long time if he didn't screw it up for himself.
Yep.
But that was under Wick. Does Bill Chisholm follow the Wick school of thought of, hey, I want to give these guys time, especially since Mazzulla won a championship? Or does he follow the Lakers, Bucks kind of theory? Even the Suns, Monty Williams went to an NBA Finals. 2 years later, they fired him.
Right.
Like, does he look at that and say, hey, if they're not a championship team level team every year, I'm changing coaches. I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And that's not for me to say I think they should. But I think, I wonder, how does Bill Chisholm feel about that? Because the Celtics traditionally have been patient under Wick with head coaches.
Yeah.
But the rest of the NBA has not. So I wonder, where does Bill Chisholm fall on that line of thinking?
And he is more than justified in thinking in that way, because that's not an asset that he brought in. He's a businessman. He's a hedge fund manager or whatever. Yeah. Whatever.
And none of these assets are anything he brought in.
Right.
Really.
So it all comes together at a really unique time to kind of treat this roster like a business that needs a refresh. And I think that applies to coaching. I think that applies to your players, star, veteran, young, up-and-comer. Everything is eligible for the vetting process that comes with a new ownership. And I go back to a point I made a few moments ago. I have no reason not to trust Brad Stevens and company's ability to make the most of whatever Bill Chisholm says. Hey, you need to cut payroll and get as close to the luxury tax, if not under. Okay, great. I will accumulate these assets and be able to turn them around in 1 year's time and make this a much more financially viable and star power-wise viable situation for when Tatum and Brown return. We can couch this by also saying this sucks. You know,
and I think Brad talked about this.
Did we realize how lucky we were a year ago? I don't know if we really did.
I hope so. But yeah. Brad talked about this in his press conference at the end of the year, that we've known about this for years.
Yeah.
Like, they've seen this coming. So they should have some sort of plan. Now, they didn't know Tatum was going to get hurt. They probably deep down expected that they would, at a minimum, at least be back in the NBA Finals, you know, for 2 years in a row. But they knew this CBA cliff was coming, and they knew they were going to have to do something about it. So to me, they should have some sort of plan in place. Like, I bet you, Dan, they already have one guy picked out that they know they want to trade.
100%.
And maybe a second guy as well. And who knows? They could go down the route of trading Porzingis and Holiday and giving Sam Hauser a bigger role, especially with Tatum out.
Yeah.
Because we've seen nights where when Tatum missed time, Hauser would be a guy that they would slot into the starting lineup. So maybe that changes that calculus a little bit. But again, they've known for a long time that this is coming, and they're going to have to make a choice. And I think it's going to come down to Porzingis and Holiday. And some of us want them to choose Porzingis. Some of them want them to choose Holiday. Whichever one they choose, we're going to look back on and say, okay, is this the right one that helped you win another NBA Finals? Or are you sitting there saying, man, we made the wrong choice? So this is something, again, Brad talked about. He said they've seen this coming for years. I would hope they would have a legit plan in place to deal with it. I think it's trading Holiday and keeping Porzingis,
yep.
But I see the merit to trading Porzingis and keeping Holiday.
We'll see where they go as our guy Tom continues his grieving process back behind the glass. 617-779-7937. Amazingly enough, we're coming to the end of Jones and Keefe here on this Monday. We're getting you ready for Red Sox baseball, game one of their series and their road trip against the Milwaukee Brewers this afternoon. 2:10 first pitch. We'll get you set for that game and what we can expect and what we can hope for. Cross our fingers, cross our toes at this point for the Red Sox on their six-game road trip. We'll do that next. Back here to wrap things up on WEEI, Jones and Keefe, Dan Ball, John Lyons riding with you up until Red Sox baseball. Pregame show begins at 1:10, first pitch 2:10 for game one of the Red Sox series. We'll chat with Joe Wild, today's pregame host for the Red Sox, coming up in just about 10 minutes. But before we get to Joe's preview, John, we will get to our own as the Red Sox embark on a six-game road trip after a homestand that we talked about off the top of the show left a lot to be desired, both just in terms of your results, but also what you saw from the middle of your lineup, what you saw in terms of the length out of the starting rotation. Today is a Crochet day, and the last time we were talking about Garrett Crochet, he was in a situation where the Red Sox really needed him to eat innings, and he was then pulled after 85 pitches, which was a season low. So to kick off our conversation for what we want to see from this road trip and what we're hoping for with this team moving forward, length from Crochet and length from your starters seems to be a non-negotiable at this point. After during that last homestand, you had Hunter Dobbins, who couldn't get out of the fifth inning. You had Brian Baio, who went 4 1/3 and then four innings. You had Buehler, who went 2 1/3, got ejected, and then went five. So a breather for your bullpen, for me, is a huge part of what would constitute a successful road trip here.
Yeah, their bullpen has thrown the fourth most innings in the MLB this year in their 12th in bullpen ERA. I don't think that's a coincidence.
Right.
And last year we saw they had the 10th most innings pitched by their bullpen last season, and they were 24th in bullpen ERA. So maybe because, hey, you have Chapman, you feel a little bit better about the bullpen. I don't know. Some do, some don't. But I don't think that's a coincidence. The fourth most innings and the 12th ERA, and this is a pivotal stretch, Dan, for me, for the Red Sox coming up. Because you have a Milwaukee team that's not that good.
Yep.
You have three games out there. Then you play an Atlanta team that now has Ronald Acuna back, has been playing better baseball over the past month or so. You have three down there. Then you have an Angels team that's not that good. But then after that, you have two series against the Yankees with the Rays sandwiched in between. Then a series against a good Seattle team after that. You need to, I think, enter into that Yankees series, which is what, 9 games from now, 2 or 3 games above 500, which means you got to do really well in this stretch here on the road. So to me, I think this is, again, they're all, and we consider and say they're all 1 out of 162. It's only Memorial Day. But if you get in a hole here and then you go into the Yankees and you're already in a hole and you don't play well there, and then you're in a deeper hole going to Seattle, all of a sudden we might be sitting here on June 15th or June 20th being like, man, they're kind of out of it. And that's a big, like, that's my concern.
That worries me more than anything else is that we talked about it earlier, how you've reached the 1/3 point of the season. And for whatever reason in Major League Baseball, Memorial Day weekend is that line of, all right, who's for real and who is not. And you're teetering on the edge of going to either side of the fence where you are a hot week away from quelling a lot of the questions that there are about your group. You're a hot week for the offensive way of maybe not caring as much about what Story's doing and what Campbell's doing and all of the different things that we complained about earlier in the show. You're also another cold 2 weeks away from being further out of the picture than you really can recover from, given the fact that now you're probably going to be missing Alex Bregman for 2 months. You're missing Tristan Casas for the year. Your rotation has already dealt with its bumps and bruises. Hauk is out. Fitz is out. You're getting to a point where if you, say, go 2-for-4 on this road trip and you can't find a way to take down the Yankees, who are playing well right now, all of a sudden, we're talking about a team that is further out of the picture than you can really recover from, and you're not that far away from that. And the fan base is also hanging by a thread right now, which I think is also important to note.
And you mentioned today's a crochet day. He's been brilliant this year, but they've wasted a lot of his starts.
Yeah.
I mean, in the month of May, he's given up a total of 5 runs in 4 starts. The Red Sox are 1-3, though, in those 4 starts.
Brutal.
Like, 5 runs allowed. Yet you're 1-3. Like, again, they're wasting. So we can sit here and say, hey, Hauk was a huge disappointment. Bayo's been a disappointment. Buehler got hurt. And all those things are true. But it's like, even when you're getting good pitching, either you're not scoring enough runs or your bullpen is blowing it late. And so that, to me, is a major problem, too. Because when you actually are getting good pitching, you can't hang with teams still. And you're 1-3. And like today, I mean, Christian Campbell's batting 104 in the month of May, and he's hitting cleanup today.
Yeah.
It's like, that's kind of the state of your lineup. Like, that's a guy that honestly should either be out of the lineup or in that 8-9 spot if you want to try to see if he can kind of get it back into a groove and get better. But instead, he's batting cleanup. And Trevor Story's been a huge disappointment. So, I mean, we talked about this earlier, too, that whenever they've had a key situation, whether it's a key pitch they had to make or a key, you know, a group of outs they had to get or a key run they had to score, more often than not, they failed to do that. And that's where you get, like, good raw numbers where, you know, you're 8th in average, 5th in runs scored. You know, your ERA as a staff is 18th. So it's like, okay, so you're scoring some runs and then not getting the key outs when you need it. Or you're 6th as a team in defensive runs saved, but you also have committed the second most errors. So some guys are playing really well defensively, and then some guys are playing terrible. So it's like, that to me is a huge problem here, where when they need a key moment, more often than not, they're not delivering.
Let's bounce back to Campbell for a moment, because it's been no secret the amount of bouncing around that he has done in his now young career as a major leaguer, where he has moved up to cleanup. He's been down, I think, as far as 7th, maybe even 8th to begin his career. He looked great. Then he's gone cold. Now he's gone really cold. He is also working out at first while playing second, while also playing center every now and again. And this cold streak has continued. And he had a couple of decent at-bats over the weekend, so I want to give credit where credit is due. But the swing still looks a little long, looks to be struggling a little bit just with the strike zone in general. Are we at all approaching a point where maybe some of these struggles would be better suited to be fixed in Worcester for a stretch?
It's a good question, because this is a guy that in April hit .287 for the month. In May, he's hitting .104.
Yeah.
And you mentioned, oh, he had some good at-bats. And look, he had 2 hits on Saturday, but he sandwiched that in between hitless game in the first game on Saturday and then 0-for-4 yesterday.
Right.
So it's like, yeah, okay, he had 2 hits, but, I mean, he's hitting .104 for the month. It's not a bad week or a bad week and a half. Like, we're May 26th, and he's hitting .104.
Month is almost over. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So you wonder, especially if they're kind of screwing around with him and like, oh, you're going to play first base now. Maybe that is something that's better. So whether it's in Worcester or just sitting him down for a few games and letting him work on that, that's a possibility as well. But this whole infield situation, now that Bregman, I mean, Marcelo Meyer's here because Bregman got hurt.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Story's given you nothing. And has not been as good this year defensively, and he's been terrible at the plate. Campbell, I think, was settling in a little bit at second base, but as you mentioned, now they might move him to first. Like, the stability on the infield is not there, and I think that's part of this problem too, that it's almost like they're reacting. Like, oh, Bregman got hurt, so let's bring up Meyer.
Yeah.
Or Casas got hurt and Devers won't play there, so let's move Campbell over. That, to me, is part of this problem too.
Is there a plan? We just talked about it when we compared Gerard Mayo to Mike Vrabel. How much of a plan is there actually with how they're deploying some of these young guys? And to poke a hole in my own theory about Campbell going down to Worcester, that would leave your infield some combination of Sogard, Story, Hamilton, and Toro, I guess, if Marcelo Meyer is or is not a part of that picture. I don't know. So that would be an ugly watch as is, even compared to what Campbell is doing right now. I'll give one other comparison, though. Jackson Holliday, now 21 years old with Baltimore, in his second season, he's hitting .262. He had .189 in 60 games at the major league level last year. They took their lumps, they sent him back down to AAA, and it looks like now in his age 21 season, he's starting to kind of put some of the pieces together. So one of the many, many storylines involved with this Boston Red Sox team here in 2025. One of the gentlemen who you've heard talk about this team more than almost anybody else on this station in 2025 and in the years prior is our good friend Joe Weil, who jumps into the studio here ahead of the MassMutual pregame show to grace us with his presence. Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, guys. Hoping for a Sox W today to get us back to 500 for the 14th time this year. So we'll see if it happens.
You know what I don't want to hear today?
The
post-game frustration from Joe Weil.
Oh.
That started to come out lately. Heard a little bit of it yesterday. I want Joe to have a happy afternoon.
And people who listen to me, they know that's not my game. Like I not that I try to spin it positively, but I try to look at things positively. Yesterday I was maybe more exasperated than I ever have. I think the reality is starting to set in a little bit with this team. You know, you just look at the lineup, and Nesson had a graphic about it yesterday on the broadcast, the TV broadcast, and Will Fleming hit on it with me in pregame. I mean, it just, the reality is looking up and down the lineup and just seeing how many young guys are now in the lineup and guys that are either in their first full year in the big leagues or their second full year. Like you get past Duran and Devers, you go to Narvaez, you know, he's a rookie. Campbell's a rookie. Abreu's second full year. Meyer a rookie. Story obviously just hasn't hit it all this year. Toro's kind of bounced around, and then David Hamilton is in his second full year. So I think the reality now with Alex Bregman is starting to settle in a little bit. It makes it more exciting now that Marcelo Meyer's up, just in the sense that you have something to root about or root for. And then I'm hoping, and I know you guys have hit on this before, like Roman Anthony too. I want to see him up here at this point, just because I think enough is enough in AAA. He's dominated that level, and if you want to give this team a jolt in some way, I think he's part of the answer. He's not going to solve everything, but he'd obviously help, at least in my mind.
I mean, for that scenario, there are two different ways that it could go, and I don't see either being a negative right now. Either you have all three on the roster at once, and they do start to manifest themselves as this core that they're supposed to be of the next championship window of the Red Sox. I know that's the absolute pie in the sky best, but that's what we're being sold right now. So that's one. Number two, they develop on the fly in a season that already seems to be hanging in the balance of potentially being lost, and at least you give your fans something to be excited to watch as they kind of find their footing. Either way, I like that better than what I'm seeing right now.
Yeah, I'm with you. And again, I just think the expectations, and John, you probably heard me talk about this in postgame yesterday, like my expectations have just changed. I mean, Dan, you and I did shows in the offseason, and I was pretty gung-ho about this team. I thought they could win the AL East. I know we're still...
No, I was not that far off from you, Joe.
Yeah, like, listen, 55 games in, there's still plenty of the season. I do think we're probably past the point where to say it's early. And again, now you're without Alex Bregman, your best player for probably at least 2 months. We'll see how it all shakes out. But my expectations have changed for this group. And if it means now, okay, getting Roman Anthony up here and getting to see him, not only just the joy of that, like that was fun watching Marcelo Meyer the last 2 days, despite the play in the eighth inning, that was kind of bad news Bears-esque. I think that's part of what can make this season fun. In a year that has unfortunately seen one step forward, one step back just too many times, I think having him up here, I think he'll help, because this team needs some reliable bats, and there's going to be some growing pains there, but I just think he'll help.
So, Joe, you highlighted all the young guys they have in the lineup, and I think you can add the pitching staff as well, right? Like Hauk and Bayo, young guys. How much of that falls on Breslow, though? Because we've heard for years, right, they're building with these prospects and all that, but you have a lineup and a pitching staff without a lot of veterans. Like, even Crochet, your ace, only threw 146 innings last year. Buehler is maybe your quote-unquote vet, but he was inconsistent last year, good in the playoffs. How much of that is, like, should they have built with more veterans, kind of at least for depth, or is this just like, hey, Casas got hurt, Story should have been better, and what can you do?
I think it's a mix of both, right? It's extremely bad. You got extremely bad luck with Casas getting this injury. And it's funny. I always say this with the caveat of, yes, I know he wasn't good when he was here, but his track record showed that he was an above-average hitter. If I had to place a bet on it, he was going to eventually turn it around. The pitching part of this, John, to me is extremely fascinating because, yeah, you're the guy at the top is in Craig Breslow. He's a pitching guy. And we heard so much about Andrew Bailey coming in. And then that first month last year, I mean, they were amazing. The starting pitching was awesome. And you have to give them credit for what Tanner Houck did last year. The problem is he's had a dreadful year this year. They put him on the IL. not exactly sure why. Obviously, they're going to say it's something, but maybe it's most likely to just figure some stuff out. On top of that, you know, the Brian Baio part of it, to me, that's the part of it that's been really tough to watch. I mean, we saw him come up in 2023. There was a lot to like. And then last year was a down year. You saw the Netflix doc and you thought, okay, maybe it was partly a personal thing, you know, and that's why those types of documentaries are great, because you get to know more of, you know, what he was dealing with his family and them not being in the States with him. But this year, it's been a massive disappointment. I mean, just four consecutive starts of not going at least five innings. You look at, like, his Baseball Savant page, the whiff, you know, the whiff rate's not where it should be. Still getting some ground balls, but at the same time, he's not locating well. You know, the walk rate's up. I just think there's been too much of that this season, and for the infrastructure to be touted as, you know, okay, this is not revolutionary, but it's this advanced pitching infrastructure that's supposed to take this team to a new level. We saw it for a bit last year, but it's come slowly back down to earth since, and I hope they can figure it out.
Is that pitching infrastructure what caused Garrett Crochet to get yanked after 85 pitches the last time out?
Well, it was the I think Alex Cora said the sports science staff that was just saying, like, you know, they want to limit him. I think that was a fair point to want to limit him at some point this season. It was just a bad spot, right? Because the bullpen had been taxed the day before with Walker Buehler getting tossed.
Yeah.
And then to have Crochet go 5 1/3 innings in that spot was tough. And, you know, Crochet after the game talked about he was frustrated in the moment, but then, you know, everything was cool afterwards. They talked it out and, you know, he understood. But he feels like he's good to go. I mean, John, you hit on, you know, last year, right? He was limited in the second half of the season because of how many innings he threw. He feels like this year he's just good to go. So he wanted to give this team innings because he's got that ace mentality, which you do love to see. And thank goodness that part of everything has worked out, because he's been as good as advertised, you know, coming into this year.
He will be on the bump this afternoon to hopefully start off a road trip on a positive note. Joe, what can we expect on today's Mass Mutual pregame show?
We got the great Will Fleming joining us on the Mass Mutual pregame show. That's coming up at 1:20. I want to make sure, it's like I was telling Will, 12:20, because they're central time.
So yeah, right.
I'm trying to make sure I have everything right. Rob Bradford has a great interview with Nick Sogard, too,
nice.
Talking about, you know, being in the big leagues now, but starting off the year in the minors after being a major leaguer last year. We'll dive into to some Crochet stuff. We'll also get some stuff on Chad Patrick, the starting pitcher for the Brewers. He's got a couple different varieties of a cutter that'll be interesting to see how the Sox go up against him. But I'm excited to talk to Will just about what he thinks about this series and kind of where we're at right now, because again, it's a different look lineup than opening day, where you don't have your three hitter, you don't have your four hitter, and then your five hitter Trevor Story is now in your seven spot and has been scuffling all month long. So a lot needs to be figured out, but you got your pig on the bump, so that's pretty good.
Never thought I would miss the presence of Tristan Casas as much as I do, looking at Carlos Narvaez in your three hole today for the Red Sox. But Joe, always a pleasure. Thank you for jumping in and give us a few moments. And of course, thank you to our guy Joe Braverman for allowing you to come into the studio, as he is the overlord when it's Red Sox baseball time.
Yeah, I had to get the okay from Joe. You know, I was like, Joe, is it okay? Pretty pleased.
Yeah,
he said yes,
and he's holding the wiffle ball bat just as his weapon to threaten, just in case we take too much of your time. But we're coming up against it. That'll do it for Jones and Keefe here on this Monday. Dan Ball, John Lyons, pleasure to be with you. Tom Christofioli, great job behind the glass, my man. Fun as always. John, enjoy the rest of your Memorial Day. Always fun to spend a couple hours with you, my man.
It was a pleasure. Looking forward to the next time already.
Absolutely. Meanwhile, tomorrow the guys are back here on Jones and Keefe. It's a Tommy Tuesday. It's a Tier Tuesday. Always a lot of fun. They'll have plenty to catch up with the Red Sox and Patriots OTAs and a little bit of NBA playoffs as well. So stay tuned. Red Sox pregame coverage is coming up in just a couple of moments. It's game one of the series, the Red Sox and the Brewers. Garrett Crochet, Chad Patrick for a 2:10 first pitch. Our guy Joe Weil has you covered on the Mass Mutual pregame show. Will Fleming, Mike Monaco on the call for the game itself. Thanks for spending some time with us here on WEEI on this Monday. Have a happy and safe rest of your Memorial Day. We'll talk to you again soon. See ya.